If you look at where we were a year ago at this time when Omicron started to surge, we were having 800,000 to 900,000 infections and 3,000 to 4,000 deaths. Today, we had less than 300 deaths. Yesterday, we had 350 deaths. And we're having about 45,000 or anywhere from 27 to 45,000 cases. That is much, much better than we were a year ago. But it is not at a level low enough where we should feel we're done with it completely, because we're not.
Dr. Anthony Fauci on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday. Here in Los Angeles, COVID cases and hospitalizations are increasing. The weekly positivity rate is above 7%, and that's a rate we haven't seen since early September. More than 800 people are hospitalized, and that's roughly double the number from a month ago. After the Thanksgiving weekend, public health officials are warning that those numbers are likely to increase. Joining us now is Apoorva Mandavilli. She's a New York Times science and global health reporter. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Are we seeing a rise in cases across the country?
We're seeing a rise in cases across some parts of the country, but it looks like probably in a few weeks, we will be seeing rises all across the country. We're headed in that direction.
And that's because of all the travel and the gathering and all that kind of stuff during Thanksgiving?
That's right. That's exactly right. People are mingling. We've got the holidays coming up. There's already been so much travel, and there will be so much more in the next few weeks. And we know now that this virus spreads the best when people are crammed together indoors. And that's exactly what we're about to do.
And the new variant also spreads more easily, right?
It does. And that's because, you know, we already all have so much immunity that these variants that are coming up now have to be really, really good at spreading in order to get around that immunity. And so the variants that we have now are just incredibly good at infecting people.
And what are these variants? I'm getting a little confused by all the initials and the numbers these days.
I mean, fair enough, right? At least we had Greek letters for a while, but these ones don't even have that. Yeah, so we have two right now called BQ1 and BQ1.1. They're actually very closely related, and together they account for about 60% of the cases. And until recently, you know, the only one we really had to worry about was one called BA5, but that's on its way out. That's actually decreasing pretty steadily every week, and I think pretty soon it's going to be really just a very small minority. So the ones that I just said are incredibly immune evasive are BQ1 and BQ11. BA5 also was, but these are even more so. And I think that's going to be the trend. We're going to see more and more immune evasive variants that are better and better at getting around the immunity we've already built up.
So the latest booster, though, targeted BA4 and 5, correct? So how effective can it be against BQ1 and BQ1.1?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So they were designing it for BA5 because they were making the decision in September when BA5 was dominant. But of course, it's been very swiftly replaced by these new variants. And so now we have a booster for a variant that's actually not dominant. We think that it'll still be very good against severe disease and death. And so, you know, everybody who is older, immunocompromised, at risk in any way should go and get the booster. But for people who are under 50 and relatively healthy, it's not clear how much benefit it will add because it's certainly not going to prevent infections, may prevent some infections, but it's not going to be very effective. And, you know, people in that age group and who are relatively healthy already have a decent amount of protection against severe disease and death. So it's not really clear how effective these boosters will be for, you know, people who are not at high risk.
Which may explain why so few people have actually gotten it. I think the number here in Los Angeles County is just 12% have gotten this latest booster.
I think that's part of it, but I think some people also just decided not to get the vaccine even before these new variants came up. I think people are tired of getting shots, tired of getting boosters, and they just want to act like the pandemic is fully over, which it's not. But, you know, I can understand why people just don't want to look at it anymore.
Right. And I can attest from being out and about over this past weekend that people are pretty tired of wearing masks as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I commuted to the office today and I was wearing a mask, and I would say I was probably one of four people in my entire subway car wearing a mask. Everybody else was mask free.
Right. Okay. So people don't seem to care very much. But, you know, there's this mixed messaging when it comes to our government officials. You hear Fauci saying, Dr. Fauci saying the pandemic is not over, but President Biden said it is over. So whom should we believe?
Well, I think they walked that comment back by President Biden, because I think he sort of misspoke when he said the pandemic is over. I think what is over, hopefully, is the sort of trend we saw last year when, you know, the hospitals were just completely overrun with COVID patients and we were still seeing so many deaths. So I think, you know, Dr. Fauci is probably right about that, that we won't see those kinds of numbers this winter. And even if a lot of people get infected, we may not see the kinds of hospitalizations or deaths we saw last winter. But I say probably because it's November 28th, and last year, exactly at this time, was the time we heard about Omicron for the very first time. So I think none of us should really be trying to predict what happens, because this virus has surprised us over and over and over again.
Right. Well, meanwhile, there was talk about trying to develop, or there maybe there still is talk about developing a universal COVID vaccine. What's happening with that?
Not a whole lot. There was talk, and there still is talk. So there are these universal COVID vaccines that are trying to be developed. You know, there are lots of teams working on them, but it's going very, very slowly, mostly because there's actually very, very little money to work on them in this country. It's also a little more technically challenging, because, you know, the whole point of these vaccines is they target the parts of the virus that are the best at producing antibodies. And when you go after other parts of the virus, which the universal vaccines try to do, it's just not as effective. And so we're sort of facing a whole bunch of hurdles. And, you know, the candidate that's furthest along is in phase one, which is very, very early trials. So we are not looking at a universal vaccine anytime soon.
And we're not going to spend a bunch of money on it at this point?
Apparently not. I mean, we should be, because, you know, it's very clear that we need something. We can't just keep doing this sort of guessing game where, you know, in September we pick a vaccine candidate and then by, you know, 2 months later it's already outdated. So, you know, it's clear that we need something else, but Congress is not really inclined to fund it. And Moderna and Pfizer are not really very helpful to, you know, academic groups or other companies that want to use their vaccines to sort of test against. And so it's just been very complicated for anybody who's trying to work on these vaccines.
What about in other countries? Are they further ahead or more willing to develop these vaccines or nasal sprays or anything along those lines?
Yeah, so universal vaccines, nobody's really very close. And it's, you know, that's because partly it is so challenging. But nasal vaccines that you mentioned, those are sort of a bit more fruitful in other countries. So now we have a bunch of countries in India, China, Russia that have nasal sprays, and China has this inhaled spray. So there are these other candidates. We're not sure exactly how good they are, because honestly, none of those companies have released the data. But it does seem like those countries are more interested, are investing more. You know, in the US, we have academic groups who are interested, but there's a group at Mount Sinai, and there's a group at, you know, Washington University in St. Louis, and they've been collaborating with scientists and companies outside the US. So like the Mount Sinai group is testing its, you know, vaccine in Mexico, and the St. Louis group worked with the company in India, because the regulatory and the funding environment here is so not friendly to these new vaccines. Those vaccines, I think, are good against, you know, preventing infection. So hopefully we'll see some activity there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks very much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Apoorva Mondavilli. She's a New York Times science and global health reporter. The Supreme Court may have made it easier to overturn gun laws here in California. A federal case is testing that now in San Diego. The Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to talk about that next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier this year, when the Supreme Court struck down New York's law requiring people to have a good reason to carry a gun in a public place, one of the big questions it raised was how that ruling might affect other states with strict gun laws like California. Well, we might soon have our answer. Today in San Diego, a series of federal court challenges to California's gun laws begins. Gun rights supporters are calling it a do-over, and we're going to talk about this now with Jessica Levinson, our legal eagle here on Press Play. She teaches law at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. Well, let's just talk about this case. It was a huge deal when it came up. Remind us all about it and what the court said.
So this was one of the big cases from last term. It was one of the first big cases in about a decade that the court heard about the Second Amendment. We know that the conservative justices had really been waiting for a while, and it struck down New York's law that says if you want a permit to carry a concealed weapon, a concealed gun, you need a really good reason for doing so, and you have to prove up that reason to us. Now, the court struck down that law, but I think the bigger takeaway that we talked about was it created a new standard for evaluating all gun control restrictions, or basically all challenges under the Second Amendment. And that new standard says you look at the text of the Second Amendment and you look at history. And that's it. There's no multi-factor test. There's no how much do we need this. You look at the text and you look at history at the time that the amendment was passed. And that's a much harder standard to satisfy.
Well, isn't that debatable, though, what was happening at the time, how to interpret history? In fact, the wording of the Second Amendment has been much debated itself.
Madeline, I feel like you've asked what is the meaning of life, but with respect to the Second Amendment, but you've zeroed in on exactly why it is not at all clear, despite what I would say some people argue, it's not clear what the history is. It's not clear which portions of history we should consider and which we shouldn't. Mm-hmm. We actually talked about this with respect to the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, where Justice Alito said, I'm looking at the text and I'm looking at history, very similar to Justice Clarence Thomas's approach here. And what I and other people said is, yes, the history that is helpful to get to this conclusion. So I think you're exactly right to probe and say, but what is history and what do we actually consider? And the text itself is open to interpretation. We try and say that the text just answers these questions. It doesn't. That's why being a judge is a really hard job.
Right. A well-regulated militia. What does that mean now in, you know, our time? So tell us a little bit about this case or these cases that are before the San Diego court.
So there are basically two cases or two big types of cases. And the first type of case are the type that we're more used to, maybe the challenges to many of our gun control measures. And people who live in California know we have some of the nation's strictest gun control measures. So we're looking at challenges to our assault weapons ban, to restrictions on ammunition purchases, restrictions on how many guns you can buy within a calendar month, restrictions on batons and billy clubs even. Basically, I think very correctly, people who want to challenge gun control restrictions, specifically in California, are seeing that everything potentially is called into question as a result of this new, and I would say because of the people who would be interpreting it, harder standard to satisfy.
And why are these cases being heard in San Diego?
Because it is a good venue. It is a good, in fact, area. And there's a great judge if you want to strike down gun control measures. So there's a judge named Judge Benitez, and he actually heard a number of challenges before the Supreme Court case. He at one point compared guns to Swiss Army knives. He is, I think it's fair to say, hostile to gun control restrictions. And there is a semi-decent chance if you file a case in San Diego and a specific type of case that he might be your judge. So it is very smart. It is a great legal strategy. And we're seeing more of this throughout the country to try and pick not only your venue, but frankly, to try and pick your judge.
Interesting. Well, one of the cases is not doesn't have to do with Justice Thomas's text and history standard, but a challenge to a new law that gives people the ability to sue gun manufacturers, modeled famously after Texas's law that allows people to sue abortion providers or anyone who helped someone get that procedure. So tell us about that case and what the challenge is.
Yeah. So that case, as you said, it is a challenge based on California's response to Texas's law that basically empowered private citizens to act like attorneys general and to sue to enforce laws. The specific challenge in this case deals with a fee shifting provision of California's law. And what it says is that if you're a citizen or a group and you sue the government to basically have a gun law declared unconstitutional under the Second Amendment, then you might have to pay the government's legal fees if even one of your claims is dismissed. And the argument here is that the fee shifting provision would really threaten plaintiffs and plaintiffs' lawyers with bankruptcy, and they would make them very difficult to litigate these Second Amendment cases. So this isn't, as you said, a question of, is this gun control measure constitutional under the Second Amendment? This is a question about the fee shifting provision in this different California law that, again, is a gun control law, but it's modeled after Texas's abortion law. And very, very specifically, Gavin Newsom made no bones about it. He said, this is our answer. If this is allowed, then here's California's law.
Could you still have that part of the law without the fee, just get rid of the fee shifting and still keep the bones of it?
So I think that will be one of the questions as to whether or not you can separate the private right of action and the rest of this law from the fee shifting. And that the fee shifting is a big part of, frankly, California trying to, I think, disincentivize these types of suits.
Okay. Quickly, I want to turn now to the court itself. They're going to hear oral arguments tomorrow in a big case involving immigration. It's called the United States versus Texas. Briefly, what is this about?
So briefly, this is about the Biden administration's ability to set policy and to set priorities for who gets deported and when. We just have too many people in this country who are undocumented workers, and we cannot deport everybody all at once. It's not realistic. And so the question in the case is whether or not the Biden administration has properly set the priorities for who would get deported and whether or not they basically went through the proper process of notice and an opportunity to be heard. And finally, whether or not states have standing to sue to say to the Biden administration, you didn't do this the right way.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, our regular legal here on Press Play. She teaches at Loyola Law School. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the actress Constance Wu has a new memoir out. Fresh Off the Boat made her famous, but she says she was ready to move on when it was unexpectedly renewed for another season.
I was never able to fully be myself on the set of Fresh Off the Boat. I was always quiet. So I had been looking forward to this fresh start for a long time.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Actress Constance Wu is known for her role on ABC's hit sitcom Fresh Off the Boat. She plays a mom from Taiwan who will do almost anything for her family. It's based on the memoir by restaurateur Eddie Huang.
I am not letting you go to a rap concert.
Yes, Mom. They're rappers. But they're white rappers.
White. Eddie, we have been through this before and the answer is always the same.
But they're sort of Asian.
No.
But he's a doctor.
No.
Constance Wu also starred in the movies Hustlers and Crazy Rich Asians. In that film, she plays a middle-class economics professor whose boyfriend is from Singapore's elite.
Thank you.
Oh, no. Those are a few fingers. I can you very much. A little bit much, I know.
I mean, this place is gorgeous. And like the rolling green hills. I mean, there are armed guards out there. And a giant tiger.
Well, now Constance Wu has released a memoir. It's called Making a Scene. In a series of essays, she talks about growing up in Virginia and how she went from theater to TV to movies. Along the way, she shares that when she was on Fresh Off the Boat, she was sexually harassed by a producer, which eventually led to a suicide attempt. We'll talk about these issues in our conversation, so please decide how and where to listen to our conversation. Constance Wu, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so let's talk about your childhood. You grew up in the suburbs near Richmond, Virginia. You were one of four girls and the child of Taiwanese immigrants. And you write that your parents were not stereotypical, like your mom wasn't a tiger mom. And she let you do pretty much whatever you wanted, within reason, I'm sure. Did your parents encourage you to be an actress? How did they feel about that?
I mean, yeah, they did let me do whatever I wanted, but I mean, you know, I wasn't out there trying to do heroin. You know, like it wasn't like, but, you know, I would say that they just sort of let us be, especially me and my little sister, independent and make our own choices and didn't really encourage or push us in either way, but let us be the guides rather than them being the guides. And so I asked to do a lot of theater. And so, yeah, they were totally cool with that.
That's so great. Because a lot of immigrant parents, they're concerned if their child says that she wants to be an actor.
You know, it's actually pretty sad to me that the people who most stereotyped my parents were Asians themselves, who refused to believe that my parents weren't like theirs, as if like they expected that all of our experiences were the same. And I think that's a big problem too. It's just within our own community, the assumption. For example, in Fresh Off the Boat, the characters in that show wore shoes in the house. They're saying, oh, Asians don't wear shoes in the house. I myself, Constance Wu, am Asian. I wear shoes in my house. And so it makes us realize how much of our own prejudices and biases we hold.
Right. And you also write about the reverse in a way, about how as an actress, you don't necessarily want to shy away from a stereotypical role or presentation of your character. And you write that you know, there are some Asian actors who refuse to play these roles. They say that success will be when being Asian is not part of the story or their character. Why don't you agree with that?
When you openly refuse to play them, I think it's almost reinforcing the ignorant mainstream's idea that people who embody those stereotypes are inherently shameful. People were so angry when my character had an Asian accent because they were reacting to old wounds where Hollywood mocked Asian accents. So I think that, there are people who genuinely embody stereotypical traits. That's not all they are. That's when stereotypes are harmful, is when they are reductive to a person rather than expansive. And I think if anyone is able to be expansive rather than reductive to an Asian American character, it would be somebody who has grown up with the Asian American experience themselves.
So getting back to your book, there are a lot of apologies in it. You apologize to your younger sister for being mean to her when you were a teenager. You apologize to a boyfriend. You apologize to your co-star, Randall Park, your co-star on Fresh Off the Boat. You apologize to your mom. So why did you feel the need to publicly apologize to all these people? And maybe a few more I've left off the list.
Oh, I mean, it's funny because you're right. I do apologize, but I don't think of the book is being very apologetic. I think of it as taking ownership. Because listen, these things I apologized for are not horrible things. Like, you know, I became silent and withdrawn and, you know, kind of pouty when Randall got this opportunity that I didn't get. Same thing with my sister. Like, I did dumb things, like we all do dumb things with our siblings, like saying, no, you can't watch that show because I want to watch this show. This is part of growing up. And anybody who says that they don't make mistakes with their siblings or with their parents and don't continue to, honestly, I think they're lying.
Yeah.
I think it's very human to get in petty squabbles with your boyfriends or with your family or with your coworkers. I mean, what I experienced on Fresh Off the Boat, I had a wonderful experience on there. And like the one small squabble I write about with Randall, all I did was be quiet and withdrawn for the most part. And I hear my best friend, Marianne, who I write about in the book, she, you know, works in a more corporate world. And there are petty squabbles like that all the time with her teams too. This is a normal part of life. So let's talk about that. Let's open it up and find out ways that it can make us better rather than making us worse. And so I think that's what I've done with all the very small things that I write about that I apologize for.
So let's talk about the Fresh Off the Boat situation where you talk about a producer named, you call M, who sexually harassed you. He would ask you for sexy selfies. He touched your thigh, your inner thigh at a Lakers game.
He touched my crotch, actually.
Your crotch. Okay.
Yes.
He was really controlling over you and your finances. Mm-hmm. And at the time, obviously, you write that you were uncomfortable. How did you handle that at the time?
I think I developed survival techniques. Anytime he would say something inappropriate, I would dismiss it with a laugh and like be like, oh my God, you're being such a dude. Ha ha. Like, which almost, you know, in hindsight, I'm embarrassed of because it seems like a type of permissiveness, which was a survival tactic for me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I felt some job security after the show had good ratings and reviews and I myself had good ratings and reviews for my performance, only then did I feel safe enough to start saying, no, that's inappropriate.
And because surprisingly, you have empathy for him. Surprisingly, you see him as also struggling to be respected in this world, this Hollywood world.
Oh, 100%. Having empathy for somebody doesn't mean you think they did the right thing, obviously.
Right.
But I do, I've been in the conversation enough to understand how Asian Americans, men, have traditionally felt emasculated by Asian American culture and how sometimes that leads Asian American men to exercise power in very, what is quote unquote considered like a safer arena. And it's sad because if you claim to be a proponent for Asian Americans, then you have to be a proponent for Asian American women because that's 50% of the population right there.
All right. So after what everyone assumed would be Fresh Off the Boat's last season, Crazy Rich Asians comes out. It's obviously a huge success. And then Fresh Off the Boat gets another season. You were not happy about that. This is very well known. You tweeted about that. And at the time you said you had some good other offers, film offers you would have to turn down. And fans were angry with you. They turned on you. So what happened after that?
Well, an Asian actress who I'd worked with, she basically sent me some very shaming, damning messages. She basically told me that I was a shame to the community and that they would be better off if I didn't even exist. And so I... this is hard to talk about, but I ended up like, basically I tried to kill myself almost. And then I ended up having to go to a psychiatric ER in New York. And it was a very scary moment because, you know, I almost lost my life over like, you know, this perfect, beautiful actress telling me that I didn't deserve to live. And I finally recognized how much I had been holding back over the years. And so I kind of had to take a break from not only social media, but kind of from Hollywood for a little bit.
But there's a line that ties the sexual harassment to your suicide attempt, right? I mean, it wasn't because you wanted other roles. It was because you were dreading going back on set, right?
It was a combination of factors. And I didn't at the time realize it was that much because that abuse was so behind me. So I thought I had quote unquote handled it after the first 2 years, after I had some job security. But, you know, it what I recognized through writing this particular essay in this book was that I was never able to fully be myself on the set of Fresh Off the Boat. I was always quiet. I was often just withdrawn. I was always professional, always empathetic. But, you know, it's weird to go to work and see everybody being buddy-buddy with their boss, who was my abuser, and to see my boss treating everybody else with the utmost respect when he treated me like dirt. So I had been looking forward to this fresh start for a long time. And I think because the renewal was such a surprise, it just brought back all the memories of abuse and how I had to repress that abuse for so many years.
Mm. All right. You end the book with an essay about your mom, and yes. It's really a powerful essay. Your mom and dad had a pretty ugly divorce. You were in college. Your younger sister was still at home, and she chose to live with your dad. And you, too, sided with your dad. You actually wrote a letter to the court.
Back then, I did, yes.
Yeah, praising him. And why did you do that? Because when you write about when you were little, how wonderful your mother was as a mom and I guess a housewife. She wasn't out in the career world yet. And apparently you got really angry with her when she decided to go and get a job.
I didn't get angry with her. I definitely don't think I got angry with her at all. But I do think that a lot of I guess housework sort of fell to the wayside as it understandably would. And so I think I just felt a change, which when you're a kid, kids don't always deal with change that mm-hmm. well. And I was not emotionally mature or intelligent enough to understand what it meant for my mom to sort of seek out her own career and her own life at that time. But I think that's what makes my feminism so important to me now, is that I can take ownership of the ways that I unconsciously was a contributor to sexism as a teenager and didn't even realize it. And I think that's powerful. But I've always tried to understand myself and my mistakes so that I could be better moving forward.
Mm. Yeah. You write about how you're so much closer to your dad, even now, right?
I think I wouldn't, you know, it's not a competition, right?
Yeah,
I wouldn't
say
closer to my dad. I think I probably have a more easygoing relationship with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that means that it's better or deeper. I just think it's different because his personality type is different. Like, just like I say with my little sister, who's like an introvert and kind of quieter. My sister's like my dad, you know, and my mom was very vibrant and extroverted, and she was a ballerina, and she was like very popular among all the Southern white ladies. She had infectious laughter. Not that I think I'm this way, but I definitely have more of those extroverted performative qualities that she has.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you are your mother's daughter, even though you rebelled against her. You didn't speak for 5 years. You were estranged for 5 years. You write about that.
Yeah.
You're back to speaking, I guess. She's back in your life. And now you have a daughter. Congratulations. And
Thank you.
So how are you looking at being a mom now? And given what you've been through and what you're writing about and your relationship with your mom, how do you view your role as a mom now?
Well, first of all, I'm like, I don't know how my mom did it with four kids, because I have one and it's like a lot of work.
Yeah.
So it gives you a newfound appreciation, right? But I do find myself parenting a lot like how both my parents parented, in that I am pretty easygoing and I don't think children are like pets that you can train, which I've had a few people who are like, oh no, you have to do this, and this is how you train them to do this, sleep training, body training, all these kind of things. And I guess I feel very much like, you know what? She's a smart girl. She's going to figure it out. Instead of trying to wrangle your child to be a certain way, it's really quite pleasurable to just watch her and see her become the way she wants to be, which I think is very much what my parents did with us. They weren't like, you have to be a straight A student. You have to have a job with like good income. They were just sort of like, oh, isn't this funny? This daughter likes to sing and dance and be on stage. Let's see what happens. And I very much feel that way about my own daughter. Let's find the things that bring her joy and meaning, and let me give her the space to discover it on her own and just enjoy watching her discover it.
Well, it has been a pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you.
Pleasure talking to you too. Thank you.
Constance Wu, her new memoir is called Making a Scene. Coming up, you may know the actress Brooke Smith from Grey's Anatomy and The Silence of the Lambs. When she was a teenager in the 80s, she took photos of her friends, punk rockers, on the Lower East Side of New York. Now those photos are collected in a new book. Brooke Smith is here to talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Why should you go around bashing one another? If they look or think different, why let it bother? That's the song Fascist Attitudes by the band Agnostic Front. They were part of the New York hardcore scene in the 1980s. Punky kids flocked to the Lower East Side, packing into legendary clubs like CBGB or The Ritz. One of those kids was Brooke Smith. She's an actress now who starred in Grey's Anatomy and The Silence of the Lambs. She's the kidnapped victim who puts the lotion in the basket. Well, in the 80s, in real life, Brooke was a rebellious teen, hanging out with the punk rock kids and photographing the scene. She took photos of the bands, of her friends, such as a roadie named Frenchie or a squatter named English Mark or even a dog named Sinner and an infant named Nadia. Brooke Smith has put all these photos in a new book. It's called Sunday Matinee. Welcome to Press Play, Brooke.
Thank you.
Why is it called Sunday Matinee?
Because they had all age shows at CB's on Sundays. And so everyone who was underage, which was pretty much every one of us, could get in.
How old were you?
When I started going, I was like 14.
14?
Yeah.
What were your parents thinking?
I mean, I don't know. They were busy.
They didn't notice that you snuck out and went to these clubs?
Yeah, no, they did notice. And I know my dad didn't love it. But the daytime shows were better, I guess.
So where were you living at the time when you discovered the scene?
So I grew up near Nyack in Rockland County, New York. Mm-hmm. And then literally the day I graduated high school, barely, I moved in. I met a guy named Fran early on. He worked at a place called Trash and Vaudeville, which I later got a job at. And, you know, Fran sold pot. Let's just admit it. And so it was a great way to meet people, hanging out at Fran's.
I just want to describe what you look like then, because there's a photo of you in the book.
Yeah.
But you have this purple kinked hair, crimped hair. And you're wearing this black nubby-looking sweater. Describe your look at the time.
Well, I mean, that was probably the best I looked. I do have a horrifying photograph of myself. At one point, I was, you know, like 220 pounds with a shaved head. I was not that attractive.
But very punk rock.
I guess I was, yeah. I think my outsides matched my insides.
So, meaning you were an unhappy kid?
I was an unhappy kid.
And why was that?
Well, I mean, a lot of reasons, but, you know, not to be a bummer, but I was sexually abused as a child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just didn't relate to anyone, it seemed, in my high school or my hometown. So, yeah, I think that's why.
So you found community with these other kids who... Also, maybe some of whom were escaping an unhappy childhood somewhere.
Yeah, like children of divorce or all kinds of different abuse. Socioeconomically speaking, it was the gamut, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did. You know, they say you recognize your tribe when you see it. And I did.
When did you pick up a camera and start photographing them?
Very early on. Like, I think even at my first show. And I'm not... I think I wanted to perform, but I was just so insecure about my body and myself that I couldn't do it. So I just, the camera made it so I could get right up in the center of the action, but still be sort of hidden. So I started kind of right away.
And did people mind that you were taking pictures of them?
I don't remember them minding. I know that when people would drive by CB's and we were sitting there, they would try to take pictures and we would, you know, try to get money out of them. but with me, no. I think people just got used to it. I had it all the time.
Well, how did you survive?
I worked, like I said, I did the bag check at Trash and Vaudeville. Uh-huh. And then I worked coat check at the Ritz. So... yeah, that was it. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have parents that I actually talked to and could borrow money from.
Ah, even though they weren't too thrilled with you being down there, I guess.
Yeah, no.
Because it was a pretty hardcore scene. I'm not just talking about the music, but just the lifestyle.
Yeah, it definitely was.
A lot of drugs, drinking.
Yeah, that. And I'm sorry to say that a lot of the people in this book are not around anymore.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah.
Because they overdosed or...
yeah, there was that. A couple died of AIDS. Hmm. Yeah, mostly drugs, though.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what is it like for you then, looking at these photos of them, and they're in their prime, they're full of energy, they're young...
yeah, you know, it's mixed because I'm the first thing I was struck by when I found them was just how young we were. I mean, we were so young.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I don't know. It was a great time for me. It was, you know, so I look, it's kind of a love letter to that time.
Well, let's talk about some of the people and some of the photos in the book. There's one in particular of, I guess this is a club. I'm not sure exactly which one, but there's, it's just chaos of like barely clad, unshirted men. And
a lot of men, too.
I think it's
huh?
called The Pit. Yeah, a lot of men. Yeah. I didn't notice that.
That's definitely CBGB's. Mm. And, you know, I was not in the pit, if you notice from the angle. I was on the stage.
Oh.
Because it was a little safer up there. Sometimes I'd be in the pit, but yeah. So, I mean, I think slam dancing evolved. I think a lot of things did, but back then we all kind of knew each other and looked out for each other. So it was, you know, the music kind of sounded like the inside of my head. Mm. And somehow in those shows, a little bit of pressure would be relieved somehow. I don't know. I would just kind of lose myself.
Yeah, I think that's a common experience in that situation in a sweaty club with really intense music playing and you're all together slamming into each other. I guess that can feel really great.
Yeah, especially if you do know, if you all know each other. You
yeah.
know? And I know that other towns, when they would come, bands from other towns would come. You know, New York, we were the hardest.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of, you know, rough thing going on in the pit then.
And then when you weren't in the pit and you weren't at the shows, in the clubs, where were you all hanging out?
Well, definitely in Tompkins Square Park.
Uh-huh.
And also a couple different squats and Fran's apartment. but yeah, a lot of people would go into these abandoned buildings and kind of make them work, you know. I saw some beautiful apartments in squats.
Did you live in a squat?
Very briefly, because I was not about to take a shower, you know, at the fire hydrant outside. I was not going to do that. I'm, you know, suburban girl. What can I say?
So you lived in an apartment nearby?
I did. Actually, I ended up getting this really cheap apartment on the Upper West Side. So I had a place up there. I lived with a girl who's in a lot of the pictures here, Alexa. And before that, I lived with John from the Cro-Mags, so he's in there.
Speaking of, let's hear a song from them. This one's called Hard Times.
Hard times coming your way.
Oh my gosh, you can really feel it. Feel the energy.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Takes me back. Takes me way back. Well, what happened to these bands?
You know, they're still playing. Agnostic Front, I just saw them at the Roxy, and I actually shot the show, which was interesting because it was very hard. I don't know how I did it.
you were younger then.
I guess. I don't know. It's just the low light and the fast action. And Cro-Mags, you know, they don't get along anymore. John and Harley, but those two for sure, they're still around. Bad Brains, not so much.
Right, and there are some really great candidates of members of the Bad Brains, and let's just play a little clip. This one's called Big Takeover. Okay, so their music talks about, well, Nazis, fascism, all that kind of stuff. Talk about the politics of this scene.
You know, Bad Brains were from D.C., mm-hmm. and they were all, and still are, black. So that was very cool, the fact that they were the best. I mean, yeah. In my opinion,
yeah.
They're just musically, and I've never seen to this day a frontman like HR. He was just unbelievable. There was all different politics. That's the truth. I mean, if I'm speaking about myself, I was, I just wanted to have a good time. I didn't like Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. I didn't know much, you know, but there were people who were very aware of what was going on politically. And then there were those, you know, who weren't.
Yeah. What is also great about this book and the photos is just the sense of family and community in them. You have photos of, you know, obviously of the pit, of people at punk shows, but you also have photos of a young woman holding her infant and a guy and his dog and just everyone sort of kind of crowding around them. Talk a little bit about that, about how you found this alternative family.
I just knew them, you know. You just recognize your people when you meet them. And these were definitely my people. I just, and to this day, I have such a strong connection with so many of them. And I think that once we found each other, it sounds very dramatic now, but we had each other's backs, you know? What is that? Trauma bonding? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just, I just know that I can count on them.
And how did you leave the scene?
Oh, well, that's kind of a bummer, too. Sorry.
There it is.
Yeah, it's my brother died when I was, he was 16, I was 18. It was just it was a freak accident. He was surfing, but yeah, it wasn't long after that I just felt it. I just felt, okay, I got to grow up now. I got to figure out what I'm doing. As John says in that song, I've got to organize my life and figure it out.
Yeah. And how old were you?
18.
So you left when you were 18.
I did, kinda. I mean, I was still around and I'd come to some shows, but differently. And I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. So, yeah, I just started pursuing acting.
So how did you decide all these years later that you wanted to put these photographs into a book?
You know, I was moving, like, I don't know, 12 years ago, and I had this box of the photos, and a friend was over, and he saw them, and he just couldn't believe them. And I had no idea that anyone would care, really. and he was like, can I show these to a curator friend of mine? And I was like, sure, that sounds fancy. So next thing you know, I had a solo show in New York of the photos.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really cool. And everybody came, which was really nice. And then since then, I've just been really trying to put it together to, you know, it was not that easy for me to do, to figure out which photos. And I mean, I have so many more, and to kind of, you know, get a flow going with the layout and all that. And so now here it is. I guess maybe the pandemic helped too.
Mm, you had some time to organize them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's also remarkable is you took all these photos when you were just a teenager.
Yes.
And did you teach yourself how to take photographs and develop them?
I did. You know, I was horrible in high school, and I loved the darkroom. And I'm still not great technically, because my husband was a director. He was a cinematographer, and it drives him crazy that I don't know, you know, like the f-stops and that. I'm like, ugh. So, yeah, for me, it was more about the composition, you know?
Yeah.
And I've made a couple films, not that anyone has seen them, but I'm sort of maybe heading that way more.
Into filmmaking, being behind the camera again.
I think so, yeah. And I think I actually would like to develop something about this time.
Hmm.
So we'll see how that goes.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, you can check out Brooke Smith's book. It's called Sunday Matinee. Also, she'll be holding a Q&A at Book Soup here in LA on Monday, December 12th. Brooke, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madeline.
And that'll do it for us today. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to our show, Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll be back again tomorrow. See you then.